2FM. Thanks to the two Johnnies, it's Wednesday the 10th of May and this is Game On. Well, after last night's feast of football, we will go again this evening with the second Champions League semi-final. This one will see AC Milan and Inter Milan do battle. David Sneijder and Miguel Delaney will be with us. And ahead of the All-Ireland Eurogrid Under-20 football final, we'll chat with Sligo manager Paul Henry. And as the Kildare Camogie team hit out of County Board disrespect after a decision to withdraw them from the All-Ireland Championship, Nadine Doherty and Aoife Murray will dissect the details. If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. David and Nadine are with me in studio and Miguel Delaney joins us on the line. Well, Miguel, where are you today?
I'm just outside of San Siro at the moment.
Fantastic.
We're walking right behind former Milan and Danish international Thomas Helveg, who's getting warmly greeted by fans.
Oh, very good.
In fairness, all you have to do is follow Miguel's Instagram and you know exactly where it is.
I just wanted to be sure in case you're one of those people that pretends you're there, Miguel, you know, superimposes yourself. Last night you were at the game as well?
Yeah, so it was a busy week. I was at the Madrid game last night, which was I'm not sure if more even than it is about it, but I thought Madrid were much better than I thought, and Madrid might actually, it's almost a bit of a contrast from last year. Like, you wonder whether Madrid will rue the opportunity not to kill City off in that spell just before the De Bruyne goal.
Seemed like that way, all right. David?
Well, in fairness, I tweeted literally about 35 seconds from the comfort of my couch. I know obviously Miguel was in the press box there, not jealous whatsoever, but like I tweeted from the comfort of my couch that like City were kind of struggling. I've never seen City being put under so much pressure by a team.
You weren't the only one, by the way. A few people had tweeted something similar.
But I kind of just said that, like, if Madrid don't get a second goal here, they're going to rule, because there's no way City aren't going to get a chance. And then I don't even think it was like a really, really good chance that fell to De Bruyne, but the way he connected with that shot and the tee up from Gundogan, who actually was actually struggling big time in that game, actually, after getting that injury in the first half. Such a good goal. Such a good goal.
Which goal was better, Vinny Jr.'s or KDB, Miguel?
I go Vinny's, I have to say. Yeah. De Bruyne is brilliant. So, Vinny Jr. was absolutely jaw-dropping. And it wasn't just the finish, which was incredible, but the whole kind of the pace of the run. And even before Camavinga's run, the ball from Modric just to release the pressure and release Camavinga. That was a brilliant goal. And the way he took it as well, didn't break stride, one touch, and then bang.
I was going to say, Miguel, was there a bit of a sense that like Pep Guardiola might have been caught on the hop a small bit where how Camavinga was deployed?
A little bit, I think. And I think they were surprised at how high he played. I mean, that's one of the things. I've done, like, obviously a fair few City games this season, including the two Bayern games. And while there's been a lot of talk, I think rightfully, about how Guardiola has gone to this old Cruyff system from Barcelona 92 with one of the fullbacks as a winger, or sorry, one of the fullbacks as a midfielder, and how that makes gives them more control. It does mean that that you can get at them on the flanks. And if City have a weakness this season that might cost them the treble, maybe it's that. And I think that's obviously something Ancelotti saw, especially the way he had Vinicius and Camavinga attacking that area so frequently. It'll probably be big in the second leg. And it's an interest, after the game in the press conference, Guardiola did actually make a point of saying, we will change something.
Because even I was like, I know after the game people were saying, well, what could Guardiola change in the second leg? And part of me is thinking, like, Phil Foden coming in and almost replacing Bernardo Silva, even though Bernardo Silva is such a good player and like tactically seems to be so aware, but in terms of that one on one, I think Foden has just a bit more about him, could actually stay with Camavinga a lot more in that position.
Yeah, I mean, on the other side of it as well, it's not just, I suppose, in defending Camavinga, but also one of the things that really struck me at City last night, especially in what was maybe their best spell in the half hour before Madrid scored. They had a lot of kind of classic City possession, but unlike obviously a lot of Premier League teams, given this is Real Madrid, but they weren't finding any sort of space. It was like Madrid knew how to keep them at arm's length, and you wonder in a situation like that whether Foden would give them some extra as well. Also, what seemed really clear as well is that Madrid centre-halves wanted Haaland to get into a physical battle because they felt that would distract his running.
And did it?
I think a little bit. I mean, it was a much quieter hand. He had two half chances. One, I mean, he could have done better with the shot, but he does that a lot where he takes an early strike, trying to surprise the keeper. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But yeah, he was certainly he was more limited than we would have seen him in a lot of big games this season as well.
And what would you put that down to, just given the, I guess, look, the conversations leading into this game and how he could potentially be the difference from last year?
Well, I think what I mean, some of it is also the way Madrid set up, which is obviously counter-attacking. I mean, even in that first half hour as well, there were spells where they had like 7 to 9 players around the box just letting space. And also we're talking about high-quality defenders in that system. Even the way Rudiger came into it and changed the tone of it. In fact, he seemed to really enjoy playing against Haaland. There's like this footage that's been going around in Spain today of him kind of like, when he was marking Haaland, the set pieces, going kind of, you know, underneath his armpits and all this sort of thing. And I think it's probably that canniness allied with how Ancelotti set up.
I think it says a lot about kind of how the game went, that more people are talking about Alfie Haaland after the match than they were about Erling, you know, considering we had to get, was it, he scored from the box he was in because he was getting involved with a bit of crack with the Madrid fans.
Yeah, and that's all the more interesting given that one of the undercurrents with Madrid is that Haaland could, well, yeah. At Madrid, they seem to firmly believe it, that Haaland will be a Madrid player within the next 3 years. Maybe he doesn't want to anger his father too much.
But he had to tweet to say what he wasn't throwing the food like he was accused of.
I know, yeah, but then he was doing the whole cup in the year.
And
in fairness, there were a few rude gestures, you see, kind of some of the wrist gestures that were going, like, so there was obviously a bit of tension there. But I don't know, I just thought going into the game, kind of falling into maybe a bit of the trap when you see so much of City constantly all the time, you're kind of thinking what they can do. And in the first 20 minutes, the way they were kind of just passing Madrid to death, really, and they weren't able to really create much, you're kind of thinking if this stays on, they're going to eventually, like, break here. But Madrid, not just because of their experience, but just because of the calibre of player, they never panicked. I know there was a lot, like, Miguel and all better from being in the stadium, you could hear the whistling and all the rest of it from the fans, but there didn't seem to be a sense of panic among the Madrid players. And the way they grew into the game, I was saying, like, it kind of makes you kind of think going into the second leg, yeah, obviously you kind of, the advantage clearly would be with City because they're at home and they're capable of doing, as you saw with Bayern Munich, they're capable of blitzing teams. But, like, it just shows you what this Madrid team seriously are capable of, even though in La Liga they were kind of struggling a little bit and took their foot off the gas once it was clear they weren't going to win it.
But, well, is that evident that there is maybe, like, I know they, like, obviously Vinicius Junior and Camavinga are so young, but there's so much experience there, and sometimes when City come up against a really big challenge, there can be a bit of a sense of vulnerability or frailty about them, or perceived anyway. Was there any sense of that last night?
Well, I wonder, I mean, there's two things with City in Ireland. Obviously, as everything you mentioned, something does come over Madrid, and even though they have so many young players now and they're consciously building one of the best young teams in Europe, that's also kind of complemented by incredible experience in some of their key players. And this team has gone through that experience last season as well. But with City, I think there's two things. One is this element where Guardiola is so controlling that as soon as something goes outside the game plan, it can scramble a team a bit. And the other side of that, which I think is really relevant right now, is that, I mean, last night was only the third time in, I think, the last 3 months that City were actually behind in a game. And the last time before that was 1st of April against Liverpool. They won 4-1. And then before that, it was early February against Tottenham Hotspur, who they always have, they have that bad record against. And you do wonder, as they've gone into this run, whether they're almost having it so easy that it cost them a little bit to adjust to a game that was a struggle. Whereas Madrid, of course, are well used to that. But, I mean, that feeds into, I suppose, why it's all the more interesting for what's to come, that both of the goals came against the run of play.
I'm going to that second leg. I don't think I've said it enough times, but yeah, I'm heading over next week, Miguel. Just on Jack Grealish, so looking at him, it seems like he's adapted now to exactly what Pep would demand of him in a game. Is that the case when you're watching him full on for 90 minutes?
Well, I think it's, I mean, I suppose this is the kind of financial strength of City. And we talk about, you know, they are an Abu Dhabi political project, and the amount of time that the manner that takes away risk, where they're in a situation where they can basically afford 100 million signings. And unlike a lot of teams that make such a signing, they don't need them to hit the ground straight away. They can give them a year to sell and adapt. And that's pretty much what happened with Grealish, in which basically he knows all the little intricacies and requirements of the Guardiola game. And some of that with Grealish is basically to know when to express himself and know more often, I think, when to basically just play the ball inside simply. Because that's often what you hear, which is what Guardiola has demanded. It's about Grealish knowing to play the ball back inside. And then he will get those moments to express himself. Although obviously it's not as free as it would have been at Aston Villa or, say, had he gone to Manchester United. But yeah, but now he has gone from someone who, I mean, really, he was almost a squad player for City last season. Whereas now he is probably what you'd say maybe their third most likely starter in attack after De Bruyne and Haaland.
It's like when you were saying there earlier about how, say, Guardiola can be so controlled, and if something happens outside the game plan, maybe that can scramble things a little bit. But that's basically what Grealish was talking about in his own understanding of why he's now with the team, because he now knows that he has to do exactly what Guardiola says in certain scenarios to a point, in terms of being in a certain part of the pitch when the ball is in a certain position. And if he's not in that position, he knows he's going to get reefed off, which is what was happening. So it's basically just, like, I know it's a very simplistic way of doing it, but basically it's the penny drop with Grealish saying he has to do exactly what Guardiola says, otherwise he's not going to play. And like, you're £100 million player, he could very easily say, well, no, I'm not going to. Like,
and especially when you think of when the role that he came from, or the club that he came from, and how he was the main man and not part of a system, and he did have that freedom and creativity, and he was the big star.
Yeah, and like, it's, don't get me wrong, you speak about Jack Grealish, and there's always that teenage part of us thinking, what might have been, you know what I mean?
That if he had, I don't think about that anymore.
To be honest, I think about it more now over the last while. It's kind of like, you know, that girlfriend who broke up with you, and you forget thinking about her for years and years, and then shows up, you're like, oh my god. But like, but the reason being is just like, it just shows you what he's actually been capable of, because he could have easily, there was all the stuff about, you know, where he was out having a few drinks and he likes to enjoy himself and have a bit of crack and all the rest of it,
and he looked like he had a lot of crack after the when they won last season.
Rightfully so, he did it at the right time, but that's something I think even with Guardiola, where if you read some of the stuff that's written about some of the City players by the lads on that beat and stuff, like, it's not something that Guardiola is totally against at the right times, where, like, when players have times off, whatever, and they do it, it's about doing it obviously at the right time and all. But the fact that Grealish could have easily been out in his ear, because, like, at City, yeah, he was a £100 million player, the most expensive British player, but like, they would have got rid of him if he hadn't have been copping on and learning and showing signs of progress. They would have got rid of him, simple as that. Like, they're not going to be in that frame where they're going to actually say, you know what, we'll put up you for another couple of years, because of the finance that's behind them. They can go and just get the next fella.
And Miguel, he seems to have kind of maintained that sense of personality as well. Like, when he is given post-match interviews, Grealish, he does seem like he is quite an engaging individual, as opposed to someone who's just part of a system.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose maybe he wasn't that popular in Ireland for so many years because of the clearing, but like, we've sat down with him 30 times, say, with the England squad. Like, we sat down with him for an hour during the World Cup, and he is a very amiable lad. He's just, like, likes a bit of a laugh, very down to earth, I would say, and easy to get along with. And obviously, I mean, the one thing that's probably been overlooked between City as well is that his willingness to, I mean, it would have been very easy for him to throw a strop at things, but he hasn't done that and has been willing to adapt. And it's the other side of all this as well. I mean, for all we're talking about £100 million signings and that brings a certain expectation, I mean, City are in a point where Guardiola has ultimate control of that club, and obviously they again, if a £100 million signing doesn't work out, it doesn't matter that much to them. So what he says goes in that regard. If he suddenly doesn't, you know, lose interest in such a player, well, that's that. And that, we saw with Cancelo, someone who had been one of the players of their season last year, and then was so ruthlessly jettisoned this year.
You tweeted last night, while you asked the question, is Vinny Jr. the best player in the world? What was the response?
I was actually, given how much Mbappe now kind of dominates the popular football culture in a way almost like Messi and Ronaldo did, it's not quite to that degree, obviously. I was actually surprised there was a lot more agreement that, although maybe some of that comes because Matt Mbappe basically only has about three or four big fixtures a year now. And you do wonder, actually, it was one of the things I was thinking as I watched that game, and Haaland and Vinicius are obviously involved in, you know, as high a stakes a game as you can get bar the final or the semi-final second leg. That does Mbappe ever think, well, what am I doing at Paris Saint-Germain? Because here's Vinny Jr., which is probably why people are talking this now, where he's not just deciding, but electrifying some of the biggest games of the planet. I mean, it didn't, like, Malik correctly or Times actually texted me earlier. I think this is a good way of putting it. Vinicius is one of those players now. If he's on TV, it's impossible to switch off, because you never know what he's going to do next. And that's part of it as well.
I have a 6-year-old who was watching the game last night with a Vinny Jr. Real Madrid jersey on, kissing the badge and jumping on the couch when he scored. So
you're not the same, 7 years old.
And the name even, they love the Vinny Jr. and everything that goes with it. So I wouldn't be surprised if he does start to overtake Mbappe's popularity in time. Let's move on to tonight's huge game between AC and Inter. I was reading a report earlier, Miguel, that there was a demand of nearly 2 million for tickets. Is that a bit excessive, or does it feel like that?
It does feel like that. I mean, even when we were trying to book travel to the game when it was confirmed it was going to happen. Hotel prices absolutely shot up. I mean, which is amazing, because we think it is a home derby in that sense. But I mean, I think whereas Inter are maybe the more localised Milan team, Milan have a huge following around Italy and also around Europe from all that Champions League success over the past few decades. And it does, yeah, I mean, there's a proper sense of occasion here. I mean, as much as a football match, it's a real kind of cultural event. And I suppose so much of that is, of course, informed by the history and what everyone remembers about Italian football and these two clubs.
And just in terms then of form and expectation, who do you think is going to have the edge tonight?
I think this is as 50-50 as you can get for a Champions League semi-final. And I think that's also because, I mean, it comes across the table given the book going for fourth. And there's a few contrasts that are part of that as well, in that Inter are probably a team without really a defined style, but maybe have more individual stars than Milan. And I also have a manager in Simone Inzaghi, Ribo's brother, who's quite good at coming up for a system for every individual. That's why they've become known as a good cup team, and he's become known as a good cup manager. Whereas Milan have a very, very defined football identity now, because they're trying to kind of, over the last few years, they've been knowing that they can't match the wealth of the Premier League or state-owned clubs like City and Paris Saint-Germain. And it's amazing that we're talking about Milan in this sense, but that's what modern football is now. They've adapted now to basically build a young squad and a high pressing approach, like a lot of these clubs are doing now. But it means they've got a very thick style. And while Inter, I think, can be quite inconsistent in terms of performance, Milan, you know what you're going to get to a certain degree. And it's a contrast, I think, that kind of adds to that and why this is 50-50. They've not been on great form, but then they've come, I mean, they are the champions of Italy, but they show that by thrashing the new champions, Napoli, away from home and in the league itself, and then obviously knocking them out in the quarterfinals. And a lot of people are talking about Napoli as the revelations of the season.
And in terms then of the occasion, it's uncharted territory for both clubs, well, as in it's unfamiliar territory really, because it's 2007 and 2010 since either team have been at this stage. What about the occasion and dealing with it? Is that going to be an issue?
I don't think, well, I mean, in terms of the player, I suppose, one of the things you keep hearing is that, although, like, it may be one of the misapprehensions about this derby, it's not really driven by hatred, say, in the way something similar like Boca Juniors or River Plate would be, like when we had that Libertadores final 2018. But it is driven by not so much the kind of the potential value of victory, but the cost of failure, which is, you know, losing such a massive game to your biggest rival. That was something that came up massively when they played in 2003 and 2005, and AC Milan won both those ties and had all sorts of banners after the game, like, we fulfill your dreams, or, you know. But I think that's what governs it, and it's why this might be kind of quite tactical, quite tight, rather than maybe as necessarily as open as last night or maybe previous Champions League games.
We were talking about Vinny Jr. earlier, but like, I know there's some doubt if he's going to play, but I just really hope Rafael Leão is going to play, because we're talking about fellas and players who, if they're on TV or you're able to watch them, I think he is not at the level of Vinny Jr. just yet, but he could be getting there.
Yeah, although it seemed, and we haven't got the starting 11s yet, but the talk in Italy was today, just as the news came out that he signed a new contract, that he might not start tonight. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if he's going to be on the bench. Probably hope he is, given he's one of the most electric players in the two teams.
And just before we finish up then, Miguel, what's it like around there? Just set the scene for us. What's the whole atmosphere?
So I'm just outside the press area now, or the press entrance, which is just the column literally above me. You can see the famous red girders and the columns. I mean, it's amazing. We're just so tight that just kind of conjures in. You can't really get more historic in terms of football. And just the concourse out around that, and at the moment it's absolutely full of fans. It's a lot more red and black tonight because Milan are the home team, but there are pockets of Inter fans around, kind of jumping around. And there's quite, I mean, it's as well-meaning an atmosphere as you can get for a game like this. And it's quite a positive affair, even though I suppose everyone's extremely nervous.
Okay, Miguel, give us a prediction, so.
I'm going to go for nil all, actually.
Oh, my God.
What a stereotype that is. The Italians love defending.
Thanks, Miguel. Enjoy it, and we'll talk to you soon. David, give us a prediction.
Nil all. No, I'm going to say 1-0, and if Leo is on the bench, I'm going to say he's going to come on and score the winner, because I just think he's a type of player who, especially in a game like this, just has something about him where he can just come on and just be a bit, like Miguel said, electric. But he just, it's not that it's
he's injured though, or is it out?
Well, it's like, I think it was like a calf. Was it a calf or a thigh issue that there was after the last game? But like, he's just one of those players where
he's really direct, isn't he?
He's direct, and obviously, like, you look at him, say like Mbappe, where he can get the ball, knock a 10 yards past you and go. But he's also one of them where if it's in a tight space and just the ability to have quick feet, shift it and get a shot away. So yeah, I'll say 1-0 to AC.
Okay, we're going to take a break. David, thank you. Miguel is gone. Nadine, stay with us. We've lots more to get through, including reflecting on all of the Camogie and ladies football action. Plus, we'll be hearing from the Sligo Under-20s manager very shortly.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Nadine Doherty is with me in studio, and we are going to turn our attention now to the ladies football and the weekend's action. Let's start with Mayo and Galway from the Connacht final that was on over the weekend. It was actually a provincial final, Nadine. I didn't know that until I saw it was on Sunday, and a really big win for Mayo, 3-13 to 2-9. A statement of intent, maybe?
Yeah, Anne-Marie, I mean, you know, going again, looking at their league form, it went completely against the league form of both teams. I mean, you had Mayo, who won one league game against a very poor Donegal, and Galway, who made it all the way to the league final. I'd say coming into the game, it meant a lot to both teams because of how the league finished for them. As I said, Mayo being so poor and Galway being so poor in the final. And these two teams have been the only senior teams in Connacht for as long as I remember. It's the first time Mayo won a Connacht Championship since 2016. So, I mean, that's pretty significant. And, you know, in these days now, you know, you hear, what is the point of provincials? You know, looking at that game on Sunday, both teams took it very seriously. I think looking at Mayo, and I did kind of feel this about them in the league, there was a master plan there, and they were all buying into what Moyles was selling them. Because while their results in the league were quite poor, you could just see glimpses of a long-term vision. And he made big calls, Marie, on Sunday in his team selection. I mean, he lined Dianne Caldwell out at centre-forward, but obviously dropped her back, and she had a job on Tracy Leonard, which she did extremely well. And he also brought Sinead Walsh on as an impact sub, who is a really, really top-class player and would probably get a place in the majority of county teams. So you can kind of see what he's doing, and a massive, I think a pretty massive statement of intent. Now, does it put them into contenders for an All-Ireland?
Well,
no.
That's the question.
For me, it doesn't. But it definitely brings something to them and their belief going forward. Because I think they see themselves as having not performed against Kerry in that semi-final last year, and they definitely see themselves as contenders. It'll definitely do them no harm, and it really sets them up nicely now for the round robin. And obviously they'll be seeded number one in a group, which is a massive thing.
And even just from a bigger picture in terms of the game and the interest in the game, seeing a good high scoring competitive game between two heavyweights this early in the season is probably what the game needs as well.
It needed it big time, Marie, because we've been talking for the last few weeks about the low scores in Ulster. Munster has been okay, and Leinster kind of up and down, but it needed that, and it delivered. It delivered, you know. And, you know, looking at Dianne Caldwell, who I mentioned earlier, and I was pretty critical of her during the league, to be honest, because she's a fantastic player, but I felt at times Mayo were possibly playing her out of position. She was phenomenal at the weekend. He dropped Shauna Howley as well. Now, maybe she was injured, I'm not sure, but he's just making big calls and they're all going with it and they're performing. So what's the space, maybe? Mm-hmm. Might add a bit of spice.
We've seen the template. We saw the template with Meath. We've now seen the template with Kerry. You know, it's not rocket science. You put structures in place, you support your players, you work hard and have a game plan, and who knows what can happen. But we do need a competitive championship, so hopefully we'll get that. Armagh and Cavan in Clonus coming up this weekend. Cavan playing for a place in the Ulster final.
Yeah, so Armagh eventually got over the line against Donegal at the weekend, which basically, now we're presuming that, you know, well, Cavan obviously are playing for this Ulster final place, and I'm presuming that Cavan will go super defensive as they did against Donegal. I mean, you're looking at Amy Mackin, you have to put something in place to counteract her danger. I do look at Armagh though, and I say this all the time, they will give up goal chances, and if Cavan do have a strength, it is up front.
Yeah.
Aisling Sheridan, I could see Cavan getting a couple of scores, maybe having a few purple patches, but I mean, Armagh have to win this, and they probably have to win it comfortably. Although I do remember a couple of years ago, and I remember Armagh beat, I think it was Monaghan, and they had to beat them by a certain score. They did that. They took a load of players off, and it meant that they got a perceived easier next round. You know, I'm not saying that they do that here. Who would they rather play, Cavan or Donegal in an Ulster final? But listen, they should win it comfortably, and then it's down to Cavan and Donegal for the other place.
So we're looking at Meath and Laois as well. Meath's still not firing, Nadine. How big a worry is it that we're now in May and we are not seeing the Meath that we've got familiar with?
Yeah, we're seeing it defensively, Marie, in fairness to them. I think they are firing fairly well defensively. That structure is definitely still in place. Niamh Gallagher, since she came into the team full time this year, she's added a lovely bit of bite going forward. But up front, Marie, it's really, really not happening. And I mean, Vicky Wall is back, as we spoke about. Emma Duggan is back. Niamh O'Sullivan had a really good league campaign, but they just need a few other players to step it up and for it to click. I think they'll get over the line against Laois. You know, Laois were really disappointing against Dublin. I expected Dublin to win, but I thought Laois would bring a little bit more to the table. But again, look, their danger is up front. You know, they've some fantastic players in Aroni Fitzpatrick and Sarah Ann Fitzgerald, Moon Ernie. I mean, really, really top quality. But that Laois, or that Meath defensive system, should hold firm, and we're looking at another Meath Dublin Leinster final, and perhaps Meath will really fire into gear then.
Are Dublin a good bit ahead of everybody else in Leinster at the moment?
Not a good bit ahead, but they're looking comfortable. And what was really interesting about their game against Laois, he started with a very strong team but experimental enough, and then at half time he brought on four all stars and they absolutely closed the game out within 20 minutes. You know, and looking at Dublin's league form, and they didn't make a league final, but they only lost, I think, two games. So they're really putting themselves in a good position.
I think with Dublin as well, we have such high expectations and they've set the standards for themselves. So when they don't meet them, even if it's only a little bit off, then there is a perception then that maybe they're not firing, but the chances are that they just have a little bit of work to do to get to where they need to, and they could probably get that done.
They have a long-term plan, essentially, that we don't know
there's
about.
There's a lot of long-term plans isn't there?
Has to be.
Cork and Waterford are playing for a place in the Munster final against Kerry, who have been so impressive this season. Both teams would have probably targeted this Munster final, I'd say.
I think so. To get a crack at Kerry, obviously, because Kerry are the standard setters. I spoke in the last few weeks, Marie, about Cork figuring out their best 15. I think they found their best 15 last weekend.
You've actually been speaking about that for more than this season.
Yeah. And do you know what I liked about Cork at the weekend? They looked like they came back with 2-4 in the last 10 minutes to draw a game. It was the kind of resilience that we saw Cork have for what, 6-7 years, winning All-Irelands. So maybe, just maybe, this group of players have really clicked and realised that they do have the potential to really challenge this year. They still have a lot of work to do, but they were very impressive. And I think with Waterford, look, they've been building their game around that defensive setup, which every new management team does. So this is their third year there. They're very resourceful in attack, Waterford. I mean, they can absorb a huge amount of pressure. I would say their scoring rate is between 60 and 70%, and that's massive. And they have very dangerous players like Breed McMahon, Kellyanne Hogan, Lauren McGregor. Like, these kind of players, they're playing very well. I still expect Cork to sneak it. I think Cork have to, really, Marie. I think they have to get into that Munster final. If they themselves have any real aspirations of really getting a good run in the All-Ireland. But it will be a tough one to call, but I think they should get over the line.
So then there's Tip and Kerry coming up. Kerry did get that reality check, conceding 2-4 against Cork in the last 10 minutes. Is this going to be a case of Kerry trying to keep that winning momentum? Will they give players some game time, maybe? It's hard to know what's the best option for them.
Yeah, you're definitely right. They definitely needed that reality check. And I mean, they didn't take a huge amount of players off in that game. So it was interesting how it did end up. But they didn't deserve to win it, and they didn't turn the knife on Cork. So I would feel he probably will give players a run this weekend, but he'll definitely keep a fairly strong 15 for the whole thing. And they lost Sheaf Rochet to injury, actually, so it'll be, in terms of line out, it'll be interesting to see if she features, and you'd hope that she does. Ciara Butler came back into goals the other day as well, so there is a, there's good competition in that Kerry team still. I still think they'd want to make a statement this weekend, and I think they'll want to go out and be tip as comfortably as they can. But listen, Ashley Maloney, who doesn't want to see her? I think that game's actually being streamed, so both those Munster games will be good ones to catch.
Aoife Murray joins us now. We'll park the ladies' football till next week. Aoife, how are you?
Good, yeah.
So Aoife, we're going to start with an off-the-field story, which we often do. So today's one is about the Kildare Camogie team. So they have hit out of what they say is a disrespectful decision from the county board to withdraw them from the All-Ireland Intermediate Championship. It's against their wishes. The players had been in dispute with Kildare Camogie over what they claim was a failure to meet the terms of an agreed charter. This is something we've heard before from another county. And then in a statement that they issued through the GPA, they said they were informed of the county board's decision through WhatsApp message on Friday and told there would be no further discussion. The Intermediate Championship is going to start this month. Kildare were finalists in 2015. They don't play at senior level. They were due to play in a group with Cork, Dublin, Kilkenny and Galway. The statement said that they have been caused great distress as a playing group. The Camogie Association have in the last little while come out themselves and tweeted. They said they're aware now of the media reports regarding Kildare's recent statement. They were not notified of this prior to its release. They are engaging with the Kildare executive and the GPA to understand the matter in its entirety to ensure all parties are heard. And just in that the Kildare players' letter to the clubs that they sent out, they said they didn't have access to showers and changing rooms. There is a number of issues that was agreed in the charter that weren't being adhered to. They're very disappointed, and it just seems like they did have meetings and they believed that they had made progress and that they might be able to salvage their season. They have trained all year round for this and they were hoping that they would get to play, but now they say their season has been ended in a disrespectful way. And it feels like, Aoife Murray, it's another week, another story. This time it's Kildare's, and it's another sorry situation really for women's sport, I feel. What do you think?
Yeah, and like there's so much in what you've just said. Yeah. It's hard to start to know where to start. Even one trying to understand it, and it's nearly harder if you could understand it, you know, because like I just wrote down a couple of words that you were saying there: showers, pitches, WhatsApp. Like, I think you'd nearly have more respect for somebody. You'd hardly break up with somebody on WhatsApp. Never mind cancel a whole championship. And like, that to me is salt into wounds that were already opened with the fact that they couldn't get such basics as showers, you know. And yeah, it's really hard. I think we said this last week, you know, I should be here talking about, you know, Waterford having a massive showing in the minor competition last weekend, you know, really pushing Cork. And Cork, you know, 4 out of 5, well, technically 4 out of 4 when you take the COVID year out of it. Like, that's what we should be talking about, these young players coming up. Now these young players, all they're seeing in the media this week is adult women not having access to showers, and their own county board, who are meant to be representing them at that executive level, at that Croke Park level, cancelling a whole season, a whole year, via WhatsApp message. It just sounds so bizarre. It really, really does. I think it's extremely hurtful, not just to Camogie, but as you said, to women's sport. We've tried to drag all this along over the past few years, but then you get hit in the face effectively with what is just pure and utter disrespect. And it's disrespect not just for players, but for people. These are women who are probably traveling out, commuting out from Dublin, commuting from college, spending their own money, trying to compete at the top level for them. It's just complete. It really is complete disrespect, I think, for women's sport in the country, never mind Camogie.
Nadine?
Yeah, agree with everything Aoife said there. And I might get Aoife on this actually at the end, because I've stepped away from playing a lot longer than you have, so you might have more of an insight in this. But a big part of it seemed to have been that the players weren't allowed to play league for their clubs. And that decision was taken solely by the county board, which again, you know, often with these things, I would have found from football anyway, that the management, the county management and the county board would have liaised with clubs and so on. And let's say you have a player who's a squad player, that they'd be allowed to play in certain league games and so on, so that they're not in that limbo land where they're not getting any game time. So just the communication around that. And also perhaps with the county board, look, that they were following practices of a lot of county teams across the country, because it is, you know, I mean, it's kind of standard that a county player wouldn't play club. And maybe again with player welfare in mind, which is great and all the rest, but it's just the communication around it. You're kind of thinking, how does this happen, you know? Because I'd imagine in Kildare, Camogie, Aoife perhaps, that, you know, they wouldn't have the player numbers that you'd have in terms of Club Camogie and Cork, let's say, you know, more established counties. So you might have clubs who can't field without their county players. So again, it's just so disappointing that some kind of communication across the board wasn't used in this instance to figure that out at a local level. You know, it's
it is like scratching your head moment, isn't it? Yeah. Because it's like a reversal of what I would have experienced.
Yeah.
And what I would have experienced is a triangle of arguments, actually a square of arguments, sorry, between the player, the management of the inter-county team, the county board, and then the club, right? So if you want to square it off, that was the constant argument. Club players looking at the inter-county players, why aren't they playing? The inter-county player going to the manager going, I want to play club. The manager saying, no, I can't let you play club. The county board coming in saying they should play club.
Yes.
So it's a complete roles reversal, and that's, I suppose, the bit that I can't personally get my head around. Look, I live in Kildare. Where I live, I hardly see any girls with hurleys, okay? I don't live too far away from Naas, and that is a stronghold now of Camogie within the county. They're battling with so many other sports. Being a part of the Greater Dublin area, there's so much competition there. And now you have the body, the very local level body, who's meant to protect players. And they can't even say player welfare, because if they can't provide playing pitches that are adequate and showers, then it cannot be a player welfare reason why they won't let women play club games.
Yeah, that's it. And I mean, if you don't have those basics, how are you going to grow the game and promote the game more to get your clubs up to a level where they have 20, 25 players and the county players can abstain from the league and so on? It's just, listen, we're going to be back here. But do you know what, Marie? In one way, it's welcome, because we now have players across the country who actually realise that by speaking out, they're not going to lose anything.
Yeah.
They actually have nothing to lose. So by highlighting it, it's great.
And I think as well, Aoife and Nadine, by the time they get to the stage where they feel like they need to speak publicly, they will have done a lot to try and get playing, because
absolutely,
it's not like they go from 0 to 100 and release a statement. There is a huge amount that they do in between that. So things must be very strange for them to do that.
But even on it, it's got to a public state now, right? See, everybody's on social media posting about it. Like, Kildare is a growing population. Like, there's housing estates. Listen, I work for a developer. There's housing estates being built in Kildare. This is such a poor marketing of the game. I'm just thinking of a young girl out there who's looking to go and pick up her hurley, dreaming of putting on the white jersey, dreaming of running out onto Crow Park. And that's what she is now faced with this evening in the media, is her own county board. I feel like there has to be more to the story, because it's so bizarre that your own county board would stop players playing with their clubs and pull an inter-county team from an All-Ireland competition. To me, it is just the worst form of marketing for any sport.
Okay, on that note, Aoife, we won't have time to get on to the weekend's games. But next week we will, because there's a Munster final that I definitely want to talk about, because Clare in it, and Leinster as well. So we'll reflect next week. Aoife, thank you as always for joining us. And we will be keeping an eye on this Kildare story and seeing how it plays out over the next while. But crucially, I think we all just want to see the women back playing, because that's the most important thing, and in the right environment as well. Aoife, thanks so much. Nadine, stay with me. I'm going to get you to hang around, because we might have a few more things to talk about at the end of the show. Stay with us though. Paul Henry's coming up after this.
Game on 2FM.
Yeah,
Wow, welcome back. I did play the interview before it was ready to go. So that was Paul Henry. We'll be hearing from him shortly. He is the Sligo All Under 20 manager. So this weekend, Sligo and Kildare will battle it out in the Air Grid Under 20 All Ireland final. A little bit earlier, as you heard, I spoke to Paul Henry and I started by asking him how he got involved with this Under 20 squad.
Initially, I got involved with a friend of mine, Adrian Dunne, who had started with the development squad with Sligo GA, and I'd been doing a bit of coaching with Adrian at a club at the time, and I ended up going in along with him and started helping out at that stage. It was probably around when these lads were, or some of these lads were under 14 development stage. So we've brought a few of them through for a number of years then, and I suppose at different stages through that then, Ross Donovan was the GPO with Sligo GA at the time, and he was assisting as a development officer with them, and as a coach on coming up through the ages, and Enda Mitchell and John Paul Clarendon then as well, our coaches at the minute, joined us as we went along through the years. So we've been there quite a bit with these lads and see them grow and develop over the last number of years.
Yeah, it's amazing really, because to even get a squad at that age and to kind of see it all come into fruition, it's a rare enough thing. So what was the development process like, and what was your key areas of focus?
I suppose one of the main areas of focus was making sure these lads enjoyed it and actually ended up bonding as a good group. So it was trying to make sure that the better footballers in Sligo that wanted to play would enjoy the experience of coming into Sligo GA and end up deciding to go with the GA as opposed to try and play soccer or play rugby and leave us. So making sure then that we were at all stages and ended up that their skill level and their technical ability was improving. And I suppose we were very lucky. We came across a very, very good crop of lads, and they get on really well together, and thankfully it's coming into fruition now for them.
And just in terms of coaching, like, as you mentioned there, the fun is a huge amount of it. How much work did you need to do on the skill development side of things to get them to the level that they're at now?
I think that's happening throughout Sligo at the minute. I think between all the different schools and the different GAA coaches that are employed by Sligo GAA, and also all throughout the different clubs, the quality of coaches that are there at the minute are improving these lads. No matter where they go to, whether it's their club, whether it's their school, or whether it's into their development squads, the coaching has improved, and that's down to the work that the Sligo GAA are doing. So then I'm very, very lucky. I have three really great coaches with me in Enda Mitchell and Ross Donovan and John Paul Clarendon, who are excellent with the lads, and I suppose have, over the last number of years, have developed them and improved them each week on week as we've been going along.
It probably sounds like I'm asking a lot of historical questions, but I'm just curious, as to how you got to the level, because there'll be kind of clubs and counties and even schools and colleges out there who'd be just really interested in how you're able to, I guess in a way it sounds like, you know, build a culture and make a team believe that they could compete and beat the big dogs, as you say, in Sligo at this stage. And the fact that you're able to do it and you're able to make these players believe as well is hugely interesting. How did you make them believe?
I suppose when we got to the minor grade with a number of these lads there a few years ago, we decided that we were going to really, really test them. We knew there was quality in the group, but we needed to know, I suppose, what would happen if they came up against the big counties. So that year, we set out trying to find challenges against the bigger teams. We started off in Healy Park against Tyrone in our first challenge match of that year, and thankfully got a win up there. And straight away, the lads started to think they're in with a chance here, and that they can compete against the bigger teams. We went and played Kerry later on, a few weeks later, and down in Ennis, and ended up we lost out with 2 or 3 points. But it was a case of, they knew they had the opportunity in that game to have won that game if they had taken chances. And so straight away it kind of gave them a huge lift to know that the work that they have been doing was continuously improving them, and that they could also compete against any county in the country on their given day. So it further emphasised the fact that if we keep working really hard and improving on our skills and improving as a team and show that work rate in games, that we have a chance here. So the lads are a really, really great bunch of lads. So they end up, no matter what you ask them to do, they'll go at it, and then and they will try their best, and if they can see another solution to it, they'll come back to you with that as well and see, look, can we do it this way or can we try this? So they're constantly thinking themselves and problem solving. And I suppose from the young lads that we brought in, it's great to see now where they've developed to and what great little footballers they are, you know.
Yeah, Vera Powell did the same thing with the Ireland women's team when they were trying to qualify for the World Cup before they got to those really important games. She played a lot of higher opposition just to build the confidence, and it paid dividends as well. Now they're heading to a World Cup, so it just shows that it can be done. So fair play. And you mentioned the schools as well, and you know, I was reading that one of the schools in Sligo, they beat St Brendan's of Killarney, and of course, you know, you'd know that school from being a football, such a big football school, and having produced so many players. Yeah. But again, things like that must have really helped.
It's huge for the county, I suppose. This year, Summerhill beat St Brendan's in the All-Ireland semi-final and got through to the Hogan Cup. And unfortunately, on that day against OMA CBS, it just didn't go their way at all. And that was a very, very strong OMA team that day. Likewise, St Attractors school in Tubber Curry got to the All-Ireland B semi-final, and end up getting bet on penalties by Abby from Thurles, I believe. And it was a day, I suppose, they felt that they left it behind them as well. So, but the fact that the schools in the county are now getting to that level is huge, because now we're seeing that right through at the different age groups, right along, the younger lads are seeing that the lads of the fifth and sixth year in these schools are getting to these All-Ireland semi-finals, and they want to get there. They see praise that these lads are getting, and I suppose it's a conveyor belt. When they see this happening, they want to get to that point. So I suppose while it's going now, at the minute we want to try and keep it going.
Absolutely. You've done it the hard way though, so you've defeated Roscommon, Mayo, Galway and Kerry to reach an All-Ireland final. That's been quite a journey.
It's been a great journey. I suppose no one can, definitely nobody can say we had an easy run of it. Going away from home in each of the games, We've travelled some miles this year. In fairness, going to challenge games all over the country. We've been in Ennis and we've been in Limerick and we've been all over the place trying to get good quality games for these lads and used to being away from home as well, so that they were used to playing different pitches. And no matter where we've brought them or where we've put them, they've ended up going out and putting in a shift and putting in performances. So it's been great. And I suppose we've been very, very lucky. We've had a huge Sligo crowd that have come and follow us to Roscommon and then to Mayo and Galway. And I suppose it's been building momentum as it's been going along. And we had a massive crowd there last day in Salt Hill against Kerry. And I suppose we're hoping for the same again this weekend in Cavan.
I was standing on Saturday morning at a hurling match in Dublin, and I was chatting to a man beside me, and he was saying he was heading off. He was originally from Sligo and he was heading off. So you're definitely capturing the attention of people that might not be living in Sligo, might be marooned in different counties, which is a lovely thing, I'd say.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I suppose it's bringing people back to Sligo that haven't been there for a while, and giving them a bit of pride about Sligo again. And I suppose that's what we want to try and do and try and harness over the next while as well. You know, it's huge for the county at the minute, and I suppose it's given the place a big lift. The seniors haven't got to the Connacht final last weekend as well, give the place a lift. So it's things like that we need to keep, I suppose, trying to achieve and make sure that we can do the very best we can. You know.
So Kildare in the final. What are you expecting from that one?
It's going to be a huge battle again. I suppose we've seen how well Kildare have gone in the championship so far, with a huge epic battle against Dublin, and then last week again to get over Down in games that are at different stages, and it looked like they were going away from them, and they still managed to pull a win out of it at the very end. So it's likewise they. Sligo, so some of the Sligo lads would have ended up being beaten by Kildare in last year's All-Ireland semi-final. So they know what it's like to have played Kildare in Cavan as well. So I suppose we're hoping it'll be a different result this Saturday.
And I know you had a couple of injuries and illnesses. How is everybody fixed?
Yeah, I suppose the last few weeks have been strange. We had Dylan Walsh, our young lad who ended up scoring the winning point in the final against Galway, first in the Connacht final, and he went down with meningitis on us, so it kind of rocked us a little bit there. We were very, very worried about his health, and thankfully Dylan got back out of hospital yesterday, so he's starting to make a good recovery and building up himself every day. So it's great to hear that he's on the mend. We had a few hamstring injuries, and we've had Canis Mulligan, our captain, then get injured at the very start of the game the last day. So like we've definitely gone, as well as having to go away and had tough games against all the big boys, we've definitely had our fair share of injuries now as well at this stage. So hopefully we'll get through Saturday unscathed.
It's, you've dealt with it though, you know, and even Canis in the first 10 minutes, like you were able to overcome that setback, which is obviously a great credit to you too.
Yeah, we talked to the lads from the very start of the year about the size of the panel and that we'd need everybody that's in that panel, and it was up to each and every one of them to push each other on. And in fairness to them, that's what they do. So they don't panic and then just get on with it. And it's a case of there's nothing we can control about that now. That injury has happened, so it's time for us to move on to the next thing and let's I suppose make sure we stay in a game. And the last day after Canis got injured, pretty much straight away, when Ronan Ireland, I think, got a point for us, and we ended up getting the goal then straight away afterwards, which settled everyone down straight away, and we got back into the game. But they're very level headed lads, and I suppose the great thing is the work rate that they'll put in, and they've a great ethic about them. So I can't be prouder of them, to be honest.
Paul, thank you so much for taking the time, and best of luck at the weekend. Looking forward to following Sligo's progress, not just this weekend, but in the next few years as well.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Now, that was Paul Henry, the Sligo manager, talking to me a little bit earlier. Nadine Doherty is still here. Nadine, that's all we have time for, though.
Yes, thank you very much. It's a lovely evening.
We'll have to get home now and watch the football. We'll be back tomorrow reflecting on it all. Please join us. Betta De Silva is up next. RTE 2FM.